All right, guys, on today's episode of the Trade Busters podcast, I am very excited to have Jerry Parker with us. He is, of course, the founder of Chesapeake Capital and probably known as one of the most successful among the famous group of turtle traders. As you guys know, I've been big into having guests on lately for kind of the alternative space, ETFs, the trend following. And I had Andrew Beer, Corey Hofstein. And recently, Jerry has launched a new ETF, TFPN. And so it's very timely and I'm excited to have him on here to kind of chat more about the philosophy, the approach, more about trend following. So with that said, Jerry, thank you so much for joining me today on the Trade Busters.
Well, it's great to be here. I am really fond of Corey and Andrew. So I'm following in some giant footsteps here and try to keep up the pace and not let you down. But I'm an expert on trend following, which is not saying much since I've been doing it for 39 years.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I should apologize to you and my audience ahead of time because I think I have a distinct underappreciation of your accomplishments in the field. I had a vague awareness of who you were just because of the your involvement with Top Traders Unplugged. And I think you had followed me at some point. Probably because I had posted some episodes with Andrew. But honestly, I knew about the turtle traders, but I didn't really know that much. I literally had to Google what, you know, who they were, you know, when I was getting ready to have you on the pod. So, you know, this will be as much for me kind of learning about you and what you do. So why don't we start off with just a quick intro of, you know, who you are and maybe just a quick background on the story of the turtle traders and your involvement with that.
Well, that's where I got my start. I was interested in trend following when I was in my mid-20s, and I was working at an accounting firm, and I just made it my hobby to sort of learn about trend following from the best I could. No internet. So it was just mainly books and newsletters and things like that. I would watch this show, Wall Street Week, and Marty Zweig would come on, and he was a little bit of a trend follower and a risk manager. But stocks only. So that was my first sort of mentorship from afar, getting his newsletter, scraping together a couple hundred bucks to try to pay for his newsletter. And there was phone updates as well. So it was really a fun way to start. And then I answered an ad in the Wall Street Journal in 1983 for Richard Dennis to hire people to teach them how to trade futures. And I got the job. I answered the ad. 1,000 people answered the ad, and he hired 12 in the first year, I think. So I went to Chicago for the training course in two or three weeks. I can never remember if it was two or three, but it was a few weeks of training in a hotel in Chicago, December 83. And they told us all of their secrets about trend following and money management, and really how to think about the markets from a long-term point of view. As the markets will change, trend following will change, but you need to understand these basic principles so you can change with it in a good way. And in January of 84, we got $1 million to trade of his money, each of us. And we were off and running with this great atmosphere of, you know, your mentor is teaching you how to trade. His bottom line is follow the rules, follow the systems, even if you lose money. That'll be fine. And if you do lose money, I may even give you more money if you're following the rules correctly. So a really pretend environment and atmosphere, just a great way to start trading with all this positive feedback because the markets were tough. We did lose money. He did give us more money. And but after that first slow start, we had some great years in 84, 85, 86, 87 until the program ended.
So I guess to kind of set the stage, can you tell me in your own words, what is trend following and why do you think trends exist?
Well, to me, trend following is a systematic approach. I think you want to start from the premise that you're going to be systematic and maybe give following prices a shot. That would be your main input or only input is the price. And so when you run this in the back test with lots of different markets, currencies, commodities, stocks, bonds, let's say, then you're going to, the computer is going to show you, oh yeah, take small losses and let your profits run. Don't be eager to get out of the profits too quickly. And then, but you do want to not give the losses too much rope. And so you eventually see what works. And what works is a shorthand for what works is trend following. And I'm sort of systematic first. I think that's the way to approach it. You don't want to just be a trend follower without knowing the proper parameters and look back periods and the time frame and optimal placement of your stop loss and things like that. But that's what pretty much jumps out at anybody who's looking, is this idea of letting profits run, having a different mentality. If the trade is a profit, you're not going to look to get out of it very quickly. But if it's a loss, you're going to take that loss fairly quickly, certainly compared to how you handle the losers. A lot of people don't like separating those two. I treat everything the same. Well, then you're not going to follow the cliche of trend following, which is going to delineate between winners and losers. And it really is a way to preserve your capital, which is going to get hit a little bit by these small losers. And you just got to sit back and hope that the winners, the big winners, the small winners, the medium-sized winners, are going to pay for those small losses. And that's one thing that I emphasize quite a bit is outlier trades. It will, if you have your trailing stop placement in an optimal place, it will force you to stay into trades maybe a little bit longer than you're comfortable with, and absorb some volatility, and certainly put up with profit givebacks. You'll have big profits that turn into losers, maybe big profits that turn into little profits. It really is going to play with you, the psychology of, you know, approaching the markets in a way that most human beings really do not like. They do not like a 40% win rate, and so 60% of the trades are losers. Certainly not something that we would come up with by design. We'd spend a lot of time asking the computer for something better. A lot of volatility with the open trade profit, allowing that to occur. And so classic, pure, systematic trend following has I think it works because it has a lot of counterintuitive qualities, and qualities, frankly, that people really find hard to accept. So that's probably why it continues to work, because it really is a pain in the ass to implement.
You know, that's interesting, because actually my next question was going to be, what do you think is kind of the source of alpha, or in other words, why does it work? And you have a lot of emphasis on the rules, you know, following the rules. And that's one thing that really drew me to trend following when I heard, you know, not just you, but everyone talk about it, the fact that it's rules-based. But you also brought up this point about, you know, doing what's uncomfortable, right? And you had this great conversation with Niels on Top Traders Unplugged yesterday that I listened to, and talking about the fact that, you know, you don't protect open profits, for example. So you have to allow these large drawdowns to really realize those outlier gains. So do you, I always emphasize having conviction in the system, you know, partly is following the rules. And like you said, knowing that it works, but also kind of understanding why. So do you think about the fact that, you know, it's trends because of kind of these behavioral biases, or the trends appear because, you know, of crowd mentality, or do not really think about it? You just know the rules work and you follow it. It has worked. It's been working. And you kind of just stick to the system, and, you know, that's enough for you.
Well, both. You know, I definitely, there was a good explanation of how I do think about, look, we did the back test, and it's a big plus that it's hard to do. It's uncomfortable. One of the sayings we used to have, do the hard thing, do the right thing. So if you have a choice, you're like, I'm a little convicted. How should I handle, I wonder how the system should operate around taking profits or getting taking losses. Look, it's the computer is more than likely, if you have a choice and it's a little, always choose the one that's psychologically harder and tougher to do. So once again, the computer almost continually rewards you for having a trailing stop that's far away, staying in the trade longer than everyone else, you know, and because it works. And we wouldn't do it if it didn't work. And we're not into this game because we are seeking out pain, you know, like a masochist or something. But doing the hard thing, doing the right thing is a good mentality. And you need to talk to yourself sometimes when you're losing money and remind yourself of where you came from, what you know, who taught you, and these things that they said that absolutely, you know, do work. But it is nice also to know of these other explanations that I have learned over the years from smart people or psychiatrists, psychologists, math people. And the one that's my favorite is the information is slow to come out in some of these big trends, like inflation, where there was a big trend last year in short bonds as the inflation was going up. And initially it was temporary inflation. It's not going to last very long. It was, so don't really worry about it. And then more evidence that came out, it was slow coming out, the trend was building. And so if the information about the fundamental information, if it all came out very quickly, then I guess the market would adjust and gap up higher or lower, and there would be no trend to capture. But it seems that it just takes a time for the correct fundamentals to come out and for people to believe them and absorb them, because they're always a few who will want to talk bad about the trend because it doesn't sync up with the way they view the economy or the world or their opinions or the fundamentals as they view them. So I think the best trades that we've ever seen are when no one agrees with them at all. I think a good trader wants to seek out those trades. You don't want to, traders should never seek out confirmation. I prefer everyone to disagree. That's going to be the juiciest trades. Everyone is sort of surprised because a lot of the fundamentals that drive these markets are endogenous. They're coming from the markets themselves, and no one really knows these fundamentals. They're very slow to come out. And so I think one other thing I wanted to mention was you said a few minutes ago something about I don't protect my profits.
Open profits,
in some ways, yeah, open profits. I think in some ways that's true. And I'm smiling because that's what I get accused of a lot. Like, you don't take, I care about the losing trades and the open trades equally. Somehow Jerry doesn't care about the open trades as much because he's letting them just go crazy and have volatility and create all this choppiness. And I think that, honestly, I care about the open trades more than anyone because I handle them optimally. And if the computer said, hey, don't have loose pants, don't give these trades so much room to jostle around, then I wouldn't do it. But I can't ignore the fact that the computer itself says, be loose and free with these profits, get out of the losers very quickly, and just let these profits, and be willing to let a nice profit turn into a loss, which no one wants to do. In fact, some people will have these rules, sort of optimized rules, overfitted rules, or rules that just they've heard someone say, and that is, you know, move your stop up to where it's break even. That's the dumbest thing ever. Number one is because the computer says not to do that. It says, oh no, the hard thing to do for a human being would be to see this really nice little profit that you've been loving on and paying attention to for all these weeks turn into a loss. You know, and people are like, that just cannot be right. And so you really have to sell your soul to the back test done in a proper way. But certainly almost every cliche that people believe in, you can't go broke taking profits. That's one that's absolutely wrong, because you certainly can. One of the things with trend following is you're taking a lot of small losses. So you have to handle these big winning trades incredibly perfect. Because if you don't, if you shortchange and you take a small profit, or smaller than you should, by overriding it with discretion or just having a systematic approach that doesn't give enough room to these open trades, then you're not going to pay for those losing trades and you're not going to make the money that you could have made. It just takes a lot of psychologically doing the hard thing day after day and not desiring and not getting positive feedback when you would like to have it.
You know what? So funny, I just thought of when I heard you talk about that, the fact that, you know, if you're encouraged to protect profits because, you know, they're not real until you realize them or whatever. But on the flip side, I hear so many people when they have unrealized losses, they try to not to treat that as real, right? And they want to manage or adjust the trade and then go, okay, well, until I close it, it's not a loss, but in fact, you're losing, right? So if you have open gains, you're profiting. If you have open losses, you're losing. So it's kind of weird, that dichotomy. I just found that interesting.
Rich had this saying that fits right in with that, and that is that people, when they have a loss, they're very hopeful. They're very hopeful that it's going to turn into a profit, and they should be very fearful because that loss can get bigger. And when people have a big gain, they're very fearful that the gain is going to go away. But that's when they should be very hopeful that the gain is going to get bigger.
Exactly.
So it's the opposite of what we think. I had a big advantage because I was getting the math, the back test, the computers from these genius people. But then also Rich was a floor trader, and they were just naturally smart and contrarian and were able to merge, you know, the math and the back test and the computer part with kind of what really happens in the markets and how you should think about the markets. And honestly, you know, I think one of the reasons that I've had success is because I was believing in what they taught us more than most of the other people. That's it in a nutshell. We're all sitting there at the feet of the masters, learning all of this amazing stuff from these genius people in 1983. And all you had to do was believe. And they were highly credible and believable, given their intelligence, which you could tell right off the bat, and then their wealth and their humbleness. And so it was just a situation, as is everyone going to believe? You know, it's kind of like they asked, can trading be taught? That was kind of one of the questions that they supposedly were asking each other. I'll bet that it can be. And someone else would say, I bet that it can't be. But, oh yeah, it can be taught, but will you accept it? You can easily write the rules down and have people remember the rules, whether they know nothing about math or computers. But are you willing to do them and accept them and not change? And part of the problem over time is you just get very, you think you're really smart, you're making money, so let's do something better. Let's add features. Let's get away from the basics. And whenever I did that, I had to pretty quickly stop doing that and revert back to the core principles.
Well, being that the success for you is, you know, really stems from following the rules, can you give me a summary of kind of what rules you follow and which ones you find to be the most important?
Well, certainly nothing's going to make your life better or easier than having a good entry-exit system. I use breakouts. So I have a breakout entry, a breakout exit, and a fairly long-term 6 months to a year look-back period. So with my breakout systems, I'm going to hold on to winning positions for about a year on average. I'm going to hold on to positions kind of long term. Some of these big trends will go on for a year or two, as we've seen recently. And so I'm not going to be in any hurry to get out and reverse my position or protect those profits in a suboptimal way. So I hear people talk about, well, entries are not that important. Exits are more important. I always took everything to be important. And I want to have a good entry, a good exit, an optimal stop loss, you know, not something too close to the market where I'll get whipsawed, not something too far away to where you can no longer really call it a small loss. But you don't need to have a lot of talent to be able to figure out the appropriate parameters for this basic system. Certainly diversification, super important. I have been obsessed with diversifying. There are people who trade more markets than me. I'm jealous that they do that. They have more capabilities than me to access markets around the world that are not maybe exchange traded. Floor and Court is one that trades 500 markets, they say. And so I wish I could trade, you know, in
How
some of those
do you
markets.
Trade right now?
I trade 300 and 150 stocks, long and short. And the balance, the other 150, was made up of currencies, commodities, and interest rates, mostly futures. And so I trade stocks and ETFs and as well, which is very rare for a CTA trend follower to trade stocks, to trade any stocks, I'm talking, comparing that to stock indices, which they do trade. And to trade this many, I just feel like, since I'm obsessed with diversification, I can get a lot of diversification if I spend time figuring out a good way of building a portfolio of single stocks, which I have done. I think one of the keys, of course, is your choice of leverage. Like, how large are you going to trade? And trading too large is really the death of most traders. It's really caused me problems over the years. I thought I wasn't trading too large, but I really was. And so risking, you know, a 0.5% per trade, or for me, maybe 25 basis points per trade, because I trade so many markets, that kind of fits well with me. And Rich would say that the two most important things about trading are trade small and follow your system. And I agree with that. Even if you have a mediocre or average system, just doggedly following it all the time, never giving up on it, you're going to outperform most people with better ideas, probably. And but sometimes if you trade too large, that is going to impact your ability to follow the system. You're going to lose confidence. You're going to make changes to your positions to say, to survive and stay in the game, that at the wrong time, you know, you're going to reduce positions by 50%. Well, the markets will probably start trending as soon as you do that. That's happening many times. And so you don't want to get into a situation where you have to use that kind of cutback rule, where, you know, you really have to start trading smaller because you're having this really difficult drawdown. So it's very difficult to put together a trend following system, because it is like each component is easily explainable and easily doable. The problem is it's just so many different components. It's like building a very complex home with modern technology, which I've done before. And it's very difficult to get each of the little parts exactly how you should do them. The best way to figure out how to do that is listen to these podcasts, Top Traders Unplugged, and my spaces on Twitter every Friday morning at 7 a.m. We have a lot of smart people on those two shows, and they give a lot of good information on how to build these portfolios, because there's a lot of detail that goes into it. Trend following is great, and it works, and it seems really simple and very uncompromised, complex, and I think it is when it's done correctly, but there's just too many things to take care of as it relates to diversification, money management, and entry and exits.
Well, on that note of, you know, the potential simple idea, but complexity in implementation, especially when you have multiple markets. Mm. And you know, I've heard there's some school of thoughts where you can get kind of almost the same results trading a more limited number of markets. But for you, what do you see as the benefit of trading so many? And as an extension of that, why do you trade, you know, single name stocks? And I know you touched upon the fact that trading multiple markets, diversification allows you to trade smaller for each individual market. But beyond that, do you see additional benefits of all those markets and then even down to single name stocks instead of just trading indexes, for example, for the equity exposure?
Right. I think you can do pretty well trading 50, 60 markets. Don't get me wrong. I think you definitely can. My idea was to create a fund and this ETF that put trend following in just an unbelievable situation to be successful. And so let's just go crazy and trade 300 markets. And I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, well, after 20 or 40, you probably, the incremental benefit is not going to be so great. And I think that's true traditionally, but not for trend following that hunts outliers. And you're looking for about 5 or 10% of your trades to really make all of the money. And that's what trend following does. About 10% of the trades each year will make all of the money. It pays for all the little losses and makes money. So you really have to handle those outlier trades like your system wants you to. And adding these more and more markets. So with me, it should be about 30 trades per year. If you're trading 100 trades, 100 markets, it's going to be 10 trades per year. And for me, the outlier trades that are going to dominate performance are going to be spread out more than if you're only trading 50 or 60 markets. So that's kind of the benefit. You should make about the same amount of money with fewer markets, but maybe it'll be a little bit more choppy. And since I'm not doing anything as far as vol management or correlation management, I'm not adjusting positions up and down based upon the changes in correlation and volatility, I'm letting this position kind of go crazy and be very volatile and hope that it turns into an outlier. I need to do some things like trade an inordinate amount of markets to kind of smooth things out the best that I can with this, you know, system that I'm advertising is very robust, not optimized, but it's going to be very bumpy. And so I'm hoping to get a smoother ride with more and more markets. And you know, where am I going to go? I've traded every single currency possible, every commodity, except maybe like China commodities, and then every interest rate, and then ETFs on top of that, fixed income ETFs. So the only place for me to go and get those 300 markets is going to be in the stock markets and individual equities. I can go in and try to find all kinds of different companies that mostly will be maybe commodity related, lithium, uranium, steel. And these are kind of commodity based stocks that where there is not even a future that we can really trade. And milk and French fries and potatoes and things like that. So this is what I've done. And you are able, if you look high and low, to find companies that can fit in. And these stocks, this portfolio does deserve to be heavily weighted in stocks because of the diversification that it does offer. If it, you can only include markets and weight the sectors to the degree that they pay off in the diversification front. And I feel like that's what we're able to do. And this is our goal, is to say, look, whatever criticisms and dislikes you have of trend following, we really want to show people how great it is and how you really don't need too much else to go in your portfolio. We've got the stocks covered. People need to have their stock part of their portfolio traded with trend following. I think if we had every market at some time is going to need a stop loss and a trailing stop, or it's going to be kind of a really shit show if you try to avoid, you know, try to preserve your capital and all you're doing is buying and holding. So we really think this is a unique product. It doesn't exist. And we think that people are going to be able to see what trend following can really do if you get away from these indices that are just a group of stocks. That some of these stocks in the index, you may want to be long, some short, some flat. So I think intellectually and mathematically, the indices just don't work. You know, I'm long S&P, but I probably would want to be short some of the stocks in the S&P. You know, the average, the index slash average by definition is not going to have this outlier trade that some of the stocks will have. It's going to be drugged down somewhat by some of the other stocks. So I can't think of one legitimate reason. You have no massive diversification. It'll be much better to break open the S&P 500 and trade all 500. You get the diversification, you get the longs and shorts, the risk control. You can size the trade using your superior algorithm. And you can treat each individual stock the way it should be treated with the trend following system.
I guess you're losing information when you trade at the index level, right? Because you're trying to get signals from the price action. But if you just lump them onto the index instead of following the individual symbols, I guess you're basically losing that information because the index is just like a amalgamation of, like you said, all 500 underlyings.
Exactly. And CTAs have an obsession with indexes and they don't want to trade the single stock. So it's just a wide open for me to create a product like this and to offer clients protection because people love stocks and they're worth loving, but they're just a market. They're not going to trend better. They're not going to make more money than the currencies and commodities and interest rates. But when you overlay the trend following on top of them, it can be a very good contributor to a safer portfolio. And no CTA would ever say, oh, I'm just going to trade the dollar index. Hell no. They'd say, and give up the peso and the pound and the franc and all that great diversification. No, never do that. Or I'll just trade the Goldman Sachs commodities index and give up what's going to happen in gold and crude and wheat and corn. No, look how wonderful it is. I'm long some of those. I'm short some of those. I'm legitimately applying my systematic back-tested system to each one of those. I've got this amazing diversification with entries and exits and markets. No, but when it comes to equities, yes, stock indexes. And you know, right now they're all pretty correlated. You can trade 25 stock indexes around the world, stock index futures, and they're pretty much all long. And of my 150 stocks, I'm long half maybe and short a quarter and flat the rest. So you get lots more diversification. You probably get more diversification from the stock sector than any of the other three sectors because there's just so many of them. But not if you, I trade the largest ones, or I trade tech, you know, traditionally what people would talk about. But if you really put some work into it, you can go out and find some very unique companies, and you look at their charts, they're all over the board. Some are long, some are short, some are flat. It's so much fun, and there's so much going on outside of the S&P index or the NASDAQ index that trend traders need to avail themselves of.
So you've mentioned a couple of times that you don't vol target. And I think on the episode with on TTU, you also mentioned you don't do dynamic sizing, right? So why do you not kind of add these bells and whistles that some CTAs might do?
Oh, yeah. When someone says bells and whistles, you should be very careful. So you don't really, you got to be very skeptical of adding bells and whistles. I've done it, and then I've failed when I did it, and I went back to fewer bells and whistles. So I'm choosing my words carefully. I'm not saying no bells and whistles. I'm just saying fewer. Be skeptical, okay? So, I size my trade when I put the trade on at entry based upon the recent volatility. So high vol positions, high volatility markets get smaller positions. Low volatility markets get larger positions. So this sizing the positions at entry with the entry ATR, for instance, is universal. Everyone kind of does that pretty much similarly. Trend following says let those profits run. But over the years, people have, systematic traders, CTAs, have put into their rules some of these ideas of dynamically every day after the first day, you may add or subtract from the position based upon its correlation that you perceive changing amongst the other markets or its volatility increasing. So you would maybe sell a couple today, and then if the volatility decreased in a week, then you would put some more on. So it's this almost continuous dynamic position sizing, which I wouldn't, I do it, I size the position when I put the trade on, but not continuously, you know. And so initially, I think the reason to do that, they would say, would be because of risk and wanting to smooth it out. But I think sometimes they slip up and they say, it's really fun taking profits as well. You know, the market crashed, Jerry stayed in it until his trailing stop got hit. We were able to get out quicker because of the volatility or correlation exit. So I think it's too many bells and whistles. It's too many parameters. And so I think that alone is enough to not want to do it, I want to do it. I want to do all kinds of things that makes life easier, better, smoother. Hey, look, I got 300 markets. That's exactly why I did it. But I went the 300 market route because there's no additional parameters. The robustness stays the same. But the other route of more overfitting the data historically to see, you know, where can we safely reduce and increase positions based upon correlation and volatility, I don't think I need that in my systematic approach. For one thing, I don't define risk as volatility. A volatility with big profits. So I'm like, yeah, that's fine. It's really not the same thing as my losing trade. And so the back test will sort of say, well, if you're going to look at sharp as your measurement, then you should vol target or vol adjust and correlation adjust. But if you're just going to say, okay, I'm going to risk a dollar and lose a dollar on some trades, and then on the other trades, I'm going to average making $3, then why manage your vol? Why care about the bumpiness of the equity curve? And so that's how I do it. I say, okay, I'm at a blackjack table, but it's really trading soybeans, right? So I'm going to risk a dollar, make three and I'm going to try to ignore the volatility and the, you know, in between the entry and the exit. So this is really an old school. Some people, you know, make fun of it and call it caveman, classic trend following. And everyone has graduated with all of their PhDs and their books that they've written and all of their quant titles. Into it just has to be way more complex. Jerry, he's really cute, nice little guy. Let him do his silly old-fashioned way of trading. But I only do it because I'm super conservative. And if at the end of time someone says to me, you know, you could have used this vol management and correlation management, and it would have worked out just fine. You didn't have to put up with all that volatility. I'll say, yeah, I was pretty sure that could be the case. I'm just going to err on the side of being super conservative. And because if the opposite is true, that it really does matter, and you should not be adding a lot of these bells and whistles, then that's what I was willing to accept. It's just my personality. It was going to be more conservative and more guaranteeing that I was going to win over time, and I'll just have to accept a bit more volatility.
Yeah, I tend to agree that usually less rules, less bells and whistles has a, you know, makes for a more robust system. But did it basically backtest better as well, just not having all those extra bells and whistles? Maybe not necessarily from like a sharp ratio perspective, but did it in fact just generate more profits if you just follow the pure approach?
You're right. If you must use sharp, you must use volatility. You must say, oh, volatility equals risk. Risk is volatility. If you do that, then you can make it work in the backtest to where volatility management, correlation management, whatever type of management, other than this one entry, one breakout entry, one breakout exit, and a stop loss, it cannot compete. But if you say, I'm going to look at risk differently, I don't think from a trend following point of view, the sharp translates into capital risk, risk of capital. For me, risk of capital is those small losses. And so if you compare what you're risking and what you're, the dings to your capital with the outsized positions, the outsized profits that vol targeters and correlation targeting doesn't get, the management of that, it takes smaller profits. You know, I don't get out of orange juice four or five times already in this trade. I'm still holding on. So obviously I've made more money. I don't know if I'm going to end up making more money, but probably. And that's a classic trade of sitting with a lot of ups and downs, but you end up making more money. But that's why they must include some sort of volatility measure that doesn't measure that says, hey, risk is volatility. So if you ignore that, then you'll do what I do. So yeah, it is definitely a function of more of a traditional way of looking at risk, which is probably more appropriate if you have a normal distribution. We've already stipulated that this is not a normal distribution. You have outlier trades. And so using some traditional statistics, I think, is not as good.
So you've kind of talked about the fact that you like to stick to a pure trend following approach. So how do you distinguish pure trend following from, for instance, managed futures?
Well, only in the sense that managed futures is 99.9% vol management, correlation management, no stocks, trading indices. And so I used to fight against that term, like, hey, let's quit calling it managed futures. That's a goofy term for one thing. And let's just concentrate on what we all do, which is trend following. But then over time, it was, you know, trend following was watered down with the managed futures, the larger managers, the invasion from Europe, touting all this stuff about how they were going to show us all how to make it better and improve upon it. And it was quite the opposite, in my opinion. So that's now I'm like, oh, I celebrate this difference between managed futures, because now I know what I want people to know what managed futures means. It means somewhat of trend following, not really letting profits run fully, but more of a management of the open trades and trying to smooth things out with a heavy-handed approach of what they call money management, risk management, volatility management, correlation management. And certainly they will also put in there some non-trend things, once again, more smoothing, mean reversion, carry trade, pattern recognition, short-term trading, who knows? God knows what else, in order to look, smooth it out and make it more palatable. And they sell that to the clients and the institutions with, and you know what? There's no downside. There's no downside to what we're doing. And they're like, sure, no, why would I choose anything else? But I do think there is some downside as far as, like we said, increased parameters. And frankly, since you have to, since I make more money on the outlier trades than traders would make with vol management and correlation management, they have to trade a bit bigger. So their losses are just a bit bigger than mine because they're taking smaller profits. But the system is more efficient, let's say, because the sharp is better. And so that's fine, I guess. But once again, I'm calling into question using sharp at all.
So now we'll get into kind of the original reason I reached out in the first place, which is, launching the ETF. So, and that for me was exciting because I'm always kind of a proponent of more access to retail for these kind of alternative assets and strategies. Why did you guys decide to launch an ETF? Was it just to have kind of that broader demographic that can have access and exposure to your strategies?
Yes, I think there's pent-up demand for real trend following from the more retail group, people who like to invest in ETFs. It's not really anything out there that truly lets profits run. I think that I get reception from, of course, I'm going to use trend following with my stocks. I think most people, institutionally wise, they don't really like that. If they did like it, I'm sure the managed futures CTAs would give it to them. And so it's kind of a business decision, probably for them, not to upset the apple cart, not to add in single stocks, to be a sort of a crisis alpha type mentality. And we'll trade some indexes because we want that stock exposure. Our performance is going to be worse if we don't have it. But we're not going to, get up in these people's faces and say, hey, if you really want to make it better for yourself and your clients, you should really trend follow equities. We just get a lot of positive feedback from people who understand trend following. They love it. I loved it when I first heard about it. I knew nothing, but I just loved it. I thought this was fantastic. It's systematic. Are the winners going to pay for the losers? That's the question. I love diversification. I thought shorts, I don't even know what that means, but I'm sure that it's probably going to be good. You can make money if things go down. And I've just fallen in love with it every day since then. But that is very rare. And I think one out of 10 or one out of 20 people might come to that conclusion that there really is something that they understand and they like. So a lot of people in the retail space and who buy ETFs, they're like me. They've loved trend following just like I have. They just didn't have my opportunity, obviously a great opportunity to work for Richard Dennis. And one thing I got on Twitter a lot was, please do not water it down. You talk on Twitter and you talk about 300 markets and 150 stocks and pure trend following. Give us that. And I was like, sure, no problem. I'm going to do all I can. Even though this product doesn't really exist before we came out with it, evidently it's somewhat complicated for market makers to make a market in stocks and futures at the same time. We did find a great market maker. And we were able to pull it off, and but it's a very unique product, and it really says no to managed futures. CTAs are not put on this planet for traditional portfolios of stocks and bonds. Here you go. We'll give you 5 or 10% allocation if you'll give us some crisis alpha, some diversification when stocks get hit really hard. And just be quiet, sit in the corner. You work for me, and that's what I want you to do. And just do what I tell you to do. And so we were like, no. Trend following is the greatest. It's the best. It needs to be on your whole portfolio. It can be almost all your portfolio. And you're going to have the bonds. But you know what? You're not going to get killed in 2022 with your bonds. Because if I got your bonds, you're short. You're going to have your stocks. because half the portfolio is stocks, but only to the degree that the stocks add diversification, not because they're better. There's 5,000 of them. Of course, you can find a lot of diversification there versus 55 commodities. But you know what? In 2008 and in COVID, you're going to have a stop loss. You're going to have trailing stops. You're going to go short some of the stocks. And so in critical periods where there's crisis, you are going to benefit from the trend following of the equities as well, along with what CTAs do, which is the other markets really helped, you know, some of these crisis periods too. So that's our mentality, that you'll have less crisis to have crisis, to need crisis alpha, if you, from day one, wrap all those wonderful stocks up with trend following, taking small losses and letting profits run, and shorts. I mean, shorts are just so important. Sometimes there's nothing, there's nowhere to hide if you're not short. Currencies, commodities, stocks, bonds, everything, anything. And we have a small allocation to Ethereum and Bitcoin futures and some crypto-based stocks as well.
So obviously the name of the fund, the ETF is kind of self-explanatory, right? TFPN, trend following plus nothing. Is that what for you really makes this product unique? You know, the diversity of products, kind of the purity and the approach and kind of the less bells and whistles. Is that kind of the main uniqueness aspects, or is there anything else you want to add to that or touch upon?
Well, yeah, trend following plus nothing. That's what TFPN stands for. And I think it's kind of funny. I'm surprised I was able to get that through my ETF partners, but they went with it and it's kind of funny, you know? And so on one hand, yes, it is trend following. No other strategies and no watered down trend following with your vol and correlation management. Just entry breakout, entry exit, let the profits run, deal with the volatility, maximize those outliers and take small losses. But on the other hand, it's trend following everything. So I need to trademark that as well, trend following everything, because we're trying to literally trend follow as many markets as possible, every market under the sun. No market is left out, certainly not stocks, which is what everybody else wants to leave out, but not us. We're not leaving that out at all. And I'm sure if we got more assets under management, $1 billion under management, we'd have 500 markets. We'd have more stock and we would be able to access some of the markets that the firm I mentioned earlier that trades 500 markets, some of the over-the-counter swap markets that that we don't have access to now. So as time goes on, and this has been the story of my entire career, as my assets grew, I just kept being obsessed with more and more markets, because we've been trading single stocks at Chesapeake for 25 years.
I see. And, you know, you obviously have this kind of unwavering conviction in the trend following approach. You made the comment that this really could be, you know, someone's entire portfolio, for instance. And for me, what excited me about products like yours, like Corey's, like Andrew's, is the fact that not only do retail have access to these alternative strategies, but they can now have them in-house as in their own portfolio. And with the way, you know, because my podcast is kind of geared towards option trading and the way options work, you know, you can margin against any, you know, cash, stocks, whatever in your portfolio. And the idea of being able to return stack our own strategies on top of the return streams from products like yours. That does lead me to one kind of question for my own curiosity, because when you talk about return stacking, inevitably, you know, it's leverage that comes up, right? So it's always good to understand kind of notionally what you're exposed to. So I'm curious, you know, for $1, you know, invested in, you know, TFPN, what kind of notional exposures do you guys, you know, I'm sure you look at all of your positions, but is there a kind of a general sizing, like, okay, we don't go over X percent exposure, you know, relative to the NAV? You know, for example, RSBT from Corey is kind of 2x, where $1 gives you $1 exposure to trend following and $1 to bonds. Is that something, you know, it might be in the prospectus, but I figured I'd kind of get your take on that at a high level.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting subject, complex, a little bit a complex. Well, we, you know, we trade a lot of markets and we So our positions are in each market is very small, and but I think the key is, regardless of how big you are, you need to really be concerned about liquidity and make sure you're not too big a part of the market. Now, it's a little misleading because we get a lot of leverage and a lot of notional because some of the things we trade, they don't have hardly very much volatility, like currencies and interest rates. So we have to really leverage those up. And so in the short term interest rates, we'll own gazillions of those things because they move like almost nothing per day. So it's really looking at it from a notional basis is not the way to do it.
I see.
Certainly I look at it like, what's an average day for us? So maybe an average day might be 50 basis points plus or minus. So, something less than the stock market, for instance. And but yeah, the leverage thing can give you a kind of a false the notional amount can give you kind of a false reading because some of the markets don't lend themselves to that sort of measurement. I don't really like that term return stacking. I like it, and I've been th you're giving me this opportunity. I didn't know I was going to have this today because I wanted to talk about this. And so I think the great what we do at Chesapeake in this fund is that we return stack every market. So we're return stacking cattle on top of hogs, on top of the Swiss franc. So it's like each individual market is a stack. So we got 300 stacks. No one's going to outstack us. So we're just we don't trade in. We don't represent any. None of our portfolio is represented by like an index or an ETF or bonds. No, we have like 35 different interest rate markets or 40 interest rate markets. And we're stacking them individually. We're taking this incredibly precise care for all 300 of these markets and to stack them when they should be stacked, which is they're in an uptrend or they're in a downtrend, and not using them when they shouldn't be. So we're taking this amazing precision care to create this perfect portfolio every day. According to the system, it's perfect. It may start losing money all of a sudden, but we're implementing these rules per market every single day to create this perfectly stacked portfolio to grab to maximize each one of those individual positions, and staying away from, a chunk of the portfolio being in an index or which is what long only. So I don't like that. Yeah, I'm getting rid of. I'm sort of. I do know that there are rare times. This really gets to the heart of the matter. But you know what? Look, whatever people are doing, they're selling. So some people, this is how they're raising money. And for me, then I'm going to like do the opposite because this could be a way for me to raise money. So I think what I do is better, but it is, I can't deny that I'm part of the reason I'm trying to do it is because no one else is doing it. And it's my shot of being successful in this ETF arena. But this is really where the rubber meets the road. And that is trend following is so wonderful, like you've said it is. Are you saying that there are times where it will not, it can never be beaten by buy and hold? And I'm like, no, it cannot. I'm not saying that. It can definitely have inferior performance to buy and hold. And we've seen that many times. The S&P crashes and then it rallies. It has a V bottom, and it, as soon as it hits that V bottom, the CTAs are barely out of their longs, barely short, and then it goes right back to the highs. And that's happened in COVID, and it's happened many times before COVID. And so if you do this back test on how much should you then give buy and hold in the stocks and in the bonds in particular, the computer's going to say not zero. It's going to say, well, if you look at all the data, you still can allocate optimally about maybe 20% of the portfolio too long only. And if you want to look at the last 5 or 10 years, it could be much higher than that. So what I am saying though is that yes, granted, if you run around with no car insurance, no trailing stop, no stop loss, it may be okay for long periods of time. But eventually, you don't want to live life that way. You want the vast majority of your investments to be liquid, transparent, and be subject to a trend system with trailing stops and stop losses, shorts, massive diversification, all of these things that are really, you know, where does the trend start? Where does the money making start? And where does the money management end? It's like all one big thing. It's so much money management, so much concern with risk, all embedded inside of trend following. And yet with no detraction for making money. There's nothing we do that says, oh, you know, trading more markets is going to make us make less money. Using a trailing stop and a stop loss is going to make us make less money. No, there's no compromise at all. We get it all. We get the amazing risk control, the preservation of capital, unlike no other strategy, and the profit opportunities. I mean, granted, it's not concentrated, but over a long period of time, you know, it's going to be a much smoother ride and much, much better than trying to put together the perfect portfolio with 10 markets or something. So I think that's really what people have to ask themselves is, how much do you believe in trend following? And how much do you legitimately think you should have long only stocks and or bonds? And I think the answer usually is going to come down to, I agree with Jerry, but I have something I need to sell. I don't care if I sell it or not. So I'm kind of a free man. I am not, if this ETF is not successful, it's going to mean very little to me. It's not how I make my living. I make my living usually just trading my own money alongside my clients. I'm the biggest investor in the ETF. I'm the biggest investor in the private fund as well.
Although I think we were speaking earlier, you mentioned it seems like it's been getting a pretty good adoption rate since launch, even though it launched pretty recently. So I guess the last question here is, you know, and you mentioned the comment earlier, if you guys had, $1 billion under management, you might be up to 500 markets. So I think to some extent, having more markets kind of increases the potential capacity. So what do you think is potentially the capacity of this product?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think you really need to answer. I've always answered that question because at one point we did, our assets under management were over 2 billion. And I think that for me, for trend following, classic trend following, Chesapeake, me, my answer to that, it has to be you revolving around commodities, and commodities are going to limit the size of those markets, the position limits in those markets. I think there are games you can play to increase your position limits, let's say with over-the-counter swap lookalikes for futures. I've done that before. But look, there's only so much you can trade in corn and soybeans, right? And those are wonderful markets. So I don't think I would ever want to be in a situation where I could have to say to myself, my clients are not getting nearly the commodity exposure. And in the way that I want to have them exposed to it, because I'm so greedy that I have to trade 5 billion. And so I think, you know, around maybe that 1 billion level, but it all revolves around the commodity markets and getting that exposure. And that's why so many of my stocks, I'm very comfortable that a lot of the 150 equities that we trade, they're very commodity based, primarily like I said earlier, in commodities that I don't have exposure to. Asphalt, concrete. You wouldn't believe the amount of time and energy we've spent building this portfolio. And we have a gold miner, for instance. And sometimes, gold itself will have a bigger trend than the gold miner. And sometimes the gold miner might have a bigger trend. So you're getting some diversification there. And on the size of the profit and on maybe the daily movement as well. So I think it all revolves for me, the commodities and having that beautiful product and not selling out to doing all you can to raise what you can and please people. Because look, let me just tell you, all of those things we said initially, it's counterintuitive. It's hard for people to do. People don't like to do the hard thing. They don't like to hold themselves up to a standard to do the right thing. That is just as true for retail people as it is for institutional clients. They're probably the worst. They're probably the worst clients in the world to have. Because what have they done? They have pressured all of the managed futures CTAs to screw up their systems. with less trend following, more equity management. And so you certainly owe them nothing. And it's much better to listen to yourself and your heart and your gut and create a product that you're proud of, that you put your best foot forward on. Now, I didn't always do that. So, but now I can afford to do it and I want to do it. And I'm, and you can learn from my mistakes that I think pursuing what's best for yourself and your clients from day one, and that probably means a very small firm and not trying to make your bottom line raising lots of money, and but having your bottom line be better trading, perfect trading for your clients as much as you know how to do that.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. Jerry, where can the audience find out more about you, follow you, and find out more about your work?
ChesapeakeCapital.com. The Trend Following Plus Nothing website, which is TFPNETF.com. Twitter Spaces, RJ Parker, JR09. I've been on a lot of podcasts. Google that. I've done some fun podcasts, especially with Niels, and the Twitter Spaces are out there as well on X. I guess we call it X. What do we call
it? That's right.
What do we call a tweet now? I'm confused.
I think they still say tweet, but.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I'm out there. It doesn't take much to find me. And send me a direct message on Twitter if you have any questions or thoughts or clarifications.
All right. Well, we'll get all those in the show notes. Jerry, this has been a real pleasure. I've learned a lot myself. And I just want to say, really looking forward to digging in and kind of following along the progress, and want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a delight. I have been more free on this one than in most podcasts. I don't know why, but you brought it out in me. So thanks for having me. Let's stay in touch.
All right. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too.